We have been looking at the subject of the three vows and taking certain sections of the text of ascertaining the three vows from Garib Benchen, and then primarily focusing on Lochen Dharmashiri's commentary on the explanation of the three vows. And with that, trying to condense a full volume into three evenings. So Pratimoksha is difficult to condense in one talk. Of course, can never be. Bodhisattvahood, I don't even know how one would do it. Then coming to Tantra, it's just a big joke that we're even trying to attempt to it, I think. Nevertheless, we have been trying to focus. Yesterday, I spoke about the bodhisattva vows. So I'm going to continue. I think in the hurriedness, I gave you 18 instead of the 22 analogies. So yesterday, a little bit of a reference was made to the five paths. When the bodhisattva path or the Mahayana teachings are engaged with and practiced, then they can be also presented in the form of what the Buddha taught, the 10 bhumis and the five paths. Five paths are progressive maturation of a practitioner's understanding and realization of what the Buddha taught as the Prajnaparamita teachings, or simply the teachings on the relative truth, absolute truth of self and phenomena, ultimately the non-dual nature of absolute and the relative truth of self and phenomena. So what is relative truth when a practitioner begins to ponder on this question? And through understanding the relativity, one realizes the truth and the enormous wisdom in the teachings of codependency, interdependency. The main factor, the quintessence of the Buddhist teachings, are in the understanding of cause and effect. We talked a little bit of cause and effect and karma with regard to the Pratimoksha vows. Now, relativity is in understanding the magnificent multiplicity, complexity, and the brilliance, yet the intricate brilliance of the relative truth or the interdependency. We create causes, causes create experiences, and how that affects us individually and collectively. Nevertheless, the Mahayana teachings go further into not only understanding the relative truth of interdependency, but what the fundamental nature of causes and experience might be. And so further maturation of the mind of a meditator goes in exploring what is the fundamental nature of what we are temporarily calling relative truth of our experiences, relative truth of the causes of our that lead to our experiences, relative true nature, the absolute true nature of self and phenomena. So as we ponder, as we contemplate, as we examine further and further what the experiences arises, how they arise, from where they arise, and then much more deeper into what actually gives rise to it. How does this actually come into fruition? What is its fundamental nature? That leads the mind to an expansive view, a view that is able to more see and appreciate the blending, the union of fundamental nature of emptiness, in that if we look at nature of self, then again, there really cannot be a point. It's very easy examination and very easy to conclude that ultimately there is no such thing as a self that can really be seen or caught or trapped as being eternal, something very solid. So even a very little bit of examination makes it very clear that there are lots of things that we're supposed to be what may really not be there. In the same way, a fair degree of appreciation of the compoundedness of reality, of compositeness of reality, begins to become more clear to a mind that is examining the nature of self, that is examining the nature of the others. Now, when that kind of a maturation, what is called refinement of insight, then wisdom is the outcome. The resultant state, which we normally say wisdom arises. What is that wisdom? What is the wisdom that arises is actually a very honest approach and a deepened insight, a very clear insight as to what exactly are the things that we are relating to. So the mind of such a person becomes more clear in its insight as to what is the true nature of forms that we see. What is the nature of the sounds that we hear? What is the nature of tastes that we taste? What is the nature of the textures that we feel? What is the nature of the smells that we smell? And most importantly, what's the nature of feelings, emotions, and thoughts? And when you explore the nature of all that our senses relate to and capture, that mature mind, the mind with insight or the mind with the wisdom, begins to have a greater appreciation for everything. When the greater appreciation and the sense of wonderment at the beauty and the complexities of all things that actually come together, become compounded, support each other, cooperate with one another, and create sights, sounds, smell, taste, texture, thoughts, feelings, and emotions, there is a truer sense of appreciation. That truer sense of appreciation makes you more patient with everything and is very powerful in overcoming that ignorant tendency of the mind, which may not have the same kind of capacity to see clearly. And that is then, from the Buddhist philosophical perspective, called ignorant mind. Why is it called ignorant? It's not because of any other reason other than that it's unclear about everything. And in its unclear sort of state of awareness, not being clear, it's also very hurried. And in its hurriedness, it has to make some sense. Now, it's the same as a busy person trying to make sense of a conversation. It's the same thing. When we're very busy, when we're very, very hurried, we don't make much sense of anything. If you are very busy rushing from point A to point B, how clearly can you actually see anything that you pass in the distance between point A and point B? You do see things, but you don't see things at the same time. You hear sound, but you don't really hear sound. You, of course, know people express feelings and emotions, but you don't have the time to clearly see and respond to it with a much more degree of mindfulness and awareness. So consistently, when we get to a kind of a habitual existence or existence sort of impulsed by such habits, where there is busyness, where there is hurriedness, and yet you have to try to constantly articulate and make sense of this hurriedness, what happens is you have to make quick judgments. And the quick judgments are always between what you like and what you don't like. And the quick judgments of what you like and what you don't like make you gradually develop an indifferent attitude, an attitude of uncare, sort of not bothered about anything, as long as you're able to hurriedly express your quick opinions and the judgments that are quickly expressed. So, of course, that leads to a kind of a whole chaotic reverberation or kind of an energy of many causes and conditions that cannot always produce happiness because it is so instilled in quick judgments, quick opinions, hurriedly made, unfeelingly made. And therefore, the whole environment that we live in begins to then resonate with that same kind of an energy that instills unsettledness, anxiousness, hesitation, apprehension. Now that, again, comes back to the human being living in that environment. And so we feel unsettledness that aggravates aggression. We feel anxiousness that aggravates our sorrow, our discontentment. And so this whole human life is led that way. Is that where there could be basic awareness, but who's going to start is the problem. Where do we start is the problem. How do we begin to unwind and go back to point one from where things could be built up in a much more sane way, in a much more open and a much more clear way? So seeing this, the Buddha then very beautifully expounded as there is suffering. Not that there is suffering of death and dying and blood and bloodshed, but that there is this suffering where every person could live a healthy life, a happy life, particularly in the light that's what we seem to be always aspiring for. and working towards. Everything we do is targeted towards the achievement of that happiness. But that same person is simultaneously unable to at all experience the happiness he or she seeks so much, because you're trapped in this sort of continuum of anxious state, state of apprehension, state of discontentment, restlessness. And so he calls that suffering. And so everyone is suffering. The cause of suffering is nothing other than ignorance of each person that doesn't recognize one's own core basic nature. And therefore, wisdom is there in the person who realizes this. So when the fundamental nature of relative truth, what is the nature of self, what is the nature of appearance, as we talked about in the beginning, begins to grow, that insight begins to grow in the person, person finds himself, or within herself, a lot of patience and resilience to that impulse that creates the resistance, creates the restlessness, the apprehension, the doubt, the hesitation, and finds within oneself far more ability to approach forms in a very relaxed way, is able to respond to sounds with a deeper sense of appreciation of the wholesomeness of the sound, and such a person is able to cut through the repeated habitual tendencies of hurriedly saying, I like this sound, I don't like this sound. Now, to give an example, we see in the lives of our teachers, many of the teachers that we've had great fortune to be with, you find one of the exceptional qualities that you find in them is there is no animosity to forms and sounds. Leave them in a room of, you know, cacophony, noises. You all make a lot of noises, children make a lot of noises, cell phones go here, there, upside down. They're very happy. There's a sense of being able to appreciate, yes, this is also part of everything that happens. Our teachers, whenever we complained about noises, would always say, well, you should go to the kitchen also and then tell the utensils to be quiet too. You know, in the kitchen when you make plates and cups make noises. And it says, well, there are two pots and pans that make sound. These are human beings with a lot of activity and energy to have activity. Why would one complain about noise? And so they would almost see noise as melodious song. Well, very nice. It's we, the very spiritual-oriented kind of people who are out to liberate all sentient beings. Then we need silence before we can be kind. So I always say, you know, that one of the very sweet things, should we say, or amusing things that usually happens is these days the cell phones. And then when you're meditating and somebody's cell phone goes, I always like to sort of observe. Now, these days, I talk a lot about this example, so more or less people are beginning to be careful not to look. But still, you know, you have the whole energy directed towards the person. So how dare this person's cell phone go on? Especially when you are meditating, resting your mind in the nature of emptiness, then you say, that distracted my samadhi, my meditation. And so these kind of things let us see the contrast between what the mind should actually be engaging in and what we suppose is spiritual path of practice. In the case, as I was saying, our teachers, that never seems to be the problem. Also, forms, where we are, how people are reacting to us, how we relate to them, what you can get from them, what you can't get from them. There's absolutely no highs and lows. There are no near and further, far away. There's no sense of one being very big, one being very small. I lived with my teacher who had no concepts of any kind of biases at all. So, however, His Holiness was also responsible for a whole lineage. He was responsible for one of the major monasteries. So you had to almost always, and I served him sometimes in the capacity, just because of my language, that is knowing Hindi and knowing English, sometimes as his secretary. And so sometimes the monastery needed certain resources. A minister would come by and you would tell Rinpoche, please behave properly. This is a minister. And, you know, please say hello or how are you? You know, sort of relate to the person a little bit more politely. And then over the years that we were with Rinpoche, we knew he would never do what you told him. If he said, smiled a little bit, that would be nice too, sometimes we thought. But it's a way of being able to see how much you cut through the biases, which in our ordinary life is very dominant because we have something to gain from all the time. The self and the deceptions of the self is always there. The agenda is always there, no matter how much you try to be watchful. But it's very difficult to ultimately come to a point where you are not going to bring discrimination in forms, what you see. And you're going to like some and dislike the others, place some as being more important, some as less important. And what demarks the importance and the unimportance? What separates beauty from ugliness? What is a taste that can be less appreciated? Is it the effort that went into it? Is there something wrong in the calculations and the proportions of the compoundedness? What is it that brings about the biases? But we believe, our conceptual ignorant mind firmly believes that discrimination is allowed. Biases are allowed. Partiality is allowed. Therefore, something happens to your dog. Now, of course, I like dogs myself very much. That's without arguing the point. But you like your, something happens to your dog. The dog, I have a friend. Now, that comes to my mind. The dog barks a little bit differently, causes great concern to the person. Somewhere in the neighborhood, another person may be crying for days. And you do feel sorry for the person. It isn't that you do not feel sorry. But at the same time, you feel helpless in that situation. You think, oh, I should go there, I shouldn't go there. Should I ask what happened? Shouldn't I ask what happened? Is it the right thing to do? Am I intruding? Am I not intruding? We allow lots of reasonings to come in between our genuine expression of concern and love for the other person. Whereas your own thing, whether it is a dog or whether it's your own child or whether it's your own friend, becomes extraordinarily important. Now, between the dog and yourself, you are concentrated on the dog very much, making sure that the dog barks uniformly every day, let's say. But on the other hand, the doctor rings you up and says, we've discovered an irregular beating of some kind of your heart or your organ or something like that, and would you come in for another test? You forget your dog the next instant. Then it's your body. And so it's the degrees, form and the degrees of biases and discrimination in the mind has to be understood by meditators in order to truly understand the concept of bodhicitta, selfless compassion. So when the insight leads the maturity or brings about the maturity of understanding what is the true nature of self and phenomena, or what is in Mahayana teachings very importantly called the profound view of emptiness, as that is more deepened, the person becomes a lot more able to take everything in stride, to take everything as a wholeness, to appreciate everything as a wholeness. When the appreciation and the resilience, the tolerance and the patience, and a deeper sense of sort of understanding of everything being equally sort of good, equally participating, that then itself is compassion. That then gives birth to a truer sense of compassion that is not a patronizing attitude at all. Until then, compassion, which does not understand the wholesomeness, the sum totality of all composite factors, can always be an egoistic compassion, a kind of a patronizing compassion that does and will always weigh pros and cons. The eyes, the ego's involvement and agenda will always be very strong. Now, when a person is able to understand the compositeness and the empty nature of self and phenomena, such a person is then said to begin to walk the path of the Bodhisattva teachings. And here, then, we refer to the generation of the first path, which is called the path of accumulation. Why it is called the path of accumulation? Now, in terms of the 37 practices of the Bodhisattva, which are then the sort of format of understanding the five parts and the ten bhumis, a slightly different approach that is more detailed in its qualities are taught. But to keep it very sort of simple here, yesterday I had referred to path of accumulation as the path where the mind begins to first become aware of one's own awakened nature. And so this is what we have been talking about. When the mind begins to see what the true nature of self is, what the true nature of phenomena is, that's the first path that you are working with. You're working within giving rise to an awakenedness of compassion that is able to truly appreciate everything rather than being biased and discriminatory in your expression of appreciation and of generation of compassion. So yesterday, in terms of the examples, the analogies, the first three analogies of the earth, the gold, and the moon are said to be connected to the path of accumulation. So in the path of accumulation, where your mind is working with awakeness, it's working with knowing and recognizing the very core nature to being pure Buddha nature or the pure nature, such a mind then recognizes a virtue, gains little pliability, becomes the basis of virtue, and begins to walk the path of progress and development of this awakened awareness. And so because of these three qualities, the three metaphors are said to be embodied within the practitioner's mind who is working with the first path of practice. Now, fire is the next analogy that I had referred to. That is connected to the second path called the path of joining. And yesterday I had also said path of joining, as the term joining itself indicates, is the joining of aspiration of compassion with action of compassion. It bridges both of these together. So when in the mind of a meditator begins to say not only that it wishes to be compassionate, but then embodies the qualities of kindness in one's actions of body, speech, and mind, physically the person is able to have a much more patient and a kinder approach to all relative phenomena, self and others. When your speech is able to have a deeper sense of appreciation for all. And this in the traditional texts are always called praises. If you look at some of the Vajrayana literatures, you will find liturgies, you will find a lot of the prayers, what you call prayers, but there are no prayers or such in Tibetan, in the Buddhist tradition. We call them supplications or recitations. So in those recitations and supplications, a lot of emphasis is given to praises. And why that is emphasized is because of transforming speech, that you actually learn to look at things with a deeper sense of appreciation, finding more positive qualities, something nice to say, rather than sort of focusing always on something negative to say or a fault to find. It's about transformation of one's own speech. So when the speech begins to highlight an attitude, express an attitude of more goodness, of more sense of lovingness, more caring for the well-being of the others, that is then where the speech itself is becoming transformed. Likewise, if the mental attitudes of the person is also going through a process where it is not only thinking good, but the thinking goodness or the thinking compassionately is strong enough to then influence physical actions of goodness and speech to be a cause of goodness, cause of harmony, cause of praise to the others, then such a transformation of the attitude and conduct of body, speech, and mind is engaging in the path of joining. So it joins mind and body and speech completely together. So the fire analogy is where it is said to burn all the coarse obscurations or the gross obscurations. And in order for the transformation of body, speech, and mind to arise, yes, that powerful awareness will have to be able to overcome or burn anger, ignorance, desire, jealousy, selfishness, arrogance, and so forth. So that's the analogy given. The next analogy of the treasure is then said to be related to the path of seeing, the third path. Now, path of seeing is when the mind of the meditator matures furthermore into seeing the true nature as it is. At such a point, the person, the meditator, is able to realize the true nature of emptiness, not only see it as empty in appearance, but it is able to really, as we say, the word in Tibetan is dok, and that is to fully recognize, to fully have a confident and a sort of a irreversible confidence of knowing the very nature of emptiness, so powerful that that powerful realization of emptiness is able to completely dissolve any tendencies of self-grasping attitude, so that the person no longer has a selfish attitude. It doesn't have a selfish attitude because its conviction, its confidence of seeing the empty nature of the ego is extremely brilliant, or it is completely powerful. And therefore, seeing, part of seeing simply means seeing the very absolute true nature of emptiness. That, therefore, when that kind of a realization and a state is obtained by a meditator, it is then that, as the defining quality of the analogy treasure is given, it satisfies the needs of all sentient beings. It is then that your generosity is perfect, because you are only at such an accomplished state of accomplishment, so able to be confident that giving to others does not scare you at all. The scariness or the hesitation about fully engaging in generosity is always impeded by some amount of self-grasping. But where the path of seeing results into the ability to see the emptiness nature, that fear is completely dissolved. And so that is called the path of seeing, developing the treasure-like quality. The precious jewel, which has pure ethics, the lake-like metaphor, which is in regard to innate patience, the vajra-like strength that is able to withstand the impulse of all negative habits, the mountain-like, and the analogy of the mountain that is then connected to being so steadfast and immovable, unmoved by all kinds of distractions, the analogy of medicine that pacifies all the illnesses of obscurations, the virtuous mentor who skillfully is able to inspire others and benefit others, the analogy of wish-fulfilling jewel that fulfills the wish of all the others, the analogy of the sun that has the power to bring about the fruitioning or the harvesting of the crop of virtue, and the analogy of the melodious song. All of these are then categorized as analogies connected to the fourth path, path of meditation. Path of meditation is when the truth, the third path, truth of the path of seeing, leads the mind to seeing the nature as is. Then the fourth path is where that seeing is uninterrupted. It is called the path of meditation because of the seamless continuum of the mind that is able to rest in the realization of the fundamental nature of emptiness. So it is a state of samadhi, it is a state of a continuum, unbroken, within the awareness of the true nature of emptiness. Within such a continuum, the expressivity of being genuinely patient, of being able to bring about the fulfillment of the wishes of the others, and all following qualities that the analogies depict, are able to be fruition. So this is then categorized in the fourth path. Furthermore, like the king, like the storehouse of treasures, the analogy of the highway, and the analogy of the excellent messenger, yesterday what I talked about, and then what I left out, the fifth analogy of the deep well. Like a deep well, which has inexhaustible water, storehouse of water, analogy for having the limitless capacity or inexhaustible ability to fulfill the wishes of the others, and most importantly, to have an understanding mind, to have the ability to understand, and in accordance to the understanding of the minds of the others, be able to help others, be able to benefit others, is the metaphor or the analogy of the deep well full of sweet water, or the deep well of unending water, as it is written in the text. These five, last of the five analogies, are then connected to the fifth path, path of no more learning, as it is called. why it is called path of no more learning is then for that bodhisattva who has reached and accomplished the fifth path, then there is nothing more to sort of resist, no habitual patterns to still continue, no delusions to still be stuck by, no impediments of obscurations. Since there are no obscurations, there are no delusions, there are no mistaken concepts, there are no dualities, the forces of the habitual pattern no longer impede the mind of such a person, then there is nothing more else to cultivate, nothing more else to learn. Therefore, it is called the path of no more learning, often called the state of complete bodhisattvahood or the state of enlightenment. In such a state of a mind, a realized state of a mind, it is said one is able to accomplish the wishes of all the sentient beings, similar to the five metaphors given. Finally, three more metaphors are added in the text. The metaphor of a sweet, melodious musical instrument, which is then said to be expounding the wisdom of the truth. The second is the river or the unending river that flows into the ocean. Likewise, like all rivers flow into the ocean, in the same way where the knowledge flows into the absolute realization or the absolute wisdom. And then the 22nd metaphor is then said to be clouds, often a metaphor given in relation to just as clouds dissolve into the expanse of the sky, in the same way that even the very slightest of the wisdom obscurations dissolve into the expanse of Dharmakaya. So these three examples are given, but are not so much connected to outer expressions of kindness, but more a dissolution of even the very subtlest of the obscurations that a bodhisattva might have. And just as finally the 22nd analogy, a cluster of cloud dissolving into the blue sky, likewise the bodhisattva enters into a complete state of enlightenment. And that complete state of enlightenment is then said to be the exhaustion, the state of exhaustion. So that comes back to the very sort of common questions which today, as Buddhism is more learned and practiced, and most of you have heard many teachings, most people may not have, but used to be always asked, what happens after enlightenment is the big question. So what happens after that? And do you come back after enlightenment? Another very common phrase that we hear is, all teachers are enlightened, something like that. Now, you have to be very clear in your understanding that certain words we use in our normal colloquial language, and everybody is free to use them. So if you like somebody very much and you would like to call that person enlightened, there's no way anyone can stop you from saying that. People say that. When you fall in love with somebody, you say, oh, I found this most excellent partner. He looks enlightened, or she must be enlightened. So that's the kind of expression that we can use. And in the same way, you also talk a lot about teachers being enlightened. Now, that's very kind of you to say teachers are very enlightened. I always use that phrase regarding my teacher. I always call them the enlightened teachers. That's your expression of veneration. That's your expression of genuine sense of appreciation and, you know, the wisdom that they embody, the kindness that they embody. But realistically speaking, so long as you are still in this world and making sense of this world, you're not enlightened. You have to understand that. Enlightenment is an extremely profound expression that we're talking about. And one must clearly understand what it is, what it entails. So long as relativity exists and makes sense to you, you are still in a relative existence. Now, that relative existence can impact your mind. To what degree? Now, that is very varied. To some of the bodhisattvas, such as our teachers, they may try to make sense of the relativity, and sometimes I think just to humor us, they play along with it, just as a parent plays along with the seriousness of a child's play. In the same way, their compassionate mind seems to play along with our making serious of everything that we try to do in our ordinary life. But the impact of it is not so strong. Just as a child's seriousness with a certain game and a parent's involvement in that great game is such that you do pretend to be angry, but you're not really angry. You can easily let go of your role, whether the child wants you to be the boss or the slave. You can play along without really being so affronted or sort of so involved that you take that role very seriously. So you don't next day go to the office, you know, pretending to be the boss. You exactly know where to stop playing. And so it is in the same way that the minds that are able to know the relativity are able to also, in the same way, have the gap of being able to really see what is the real truth and what is that we are playing along with. Middling capacities make greater, are able to distinguish this, but with support and with help. And that's where most practitioners are. You're supported by your meditation, you're supported by the learnings, you're supported by all the shrines and the things that we use, you're supported by the different disciplines such as the vows. It allows and calls in a reminder that strengthens your awareness in being able to play along, however, without that kind of an emotional involvement that is unable to distinguish between what is true, what is real fact, and how much is just made up by the deluded mind, exaggerated by the deluded mind. And the least of the categories are ordinary human beings who are so overwhelmed by every arising moment and the experiences of the moment that their discerning mind is often submerged in the hurriedness, as we talked about, the busyness that we talked about, and therefore the ability to distinguish clearly what's real and what's not real is not so very clear. So drowned in the overwhelming experiences of one's own feelings and emotions, basic awareness is very, very fragile. It is very, very interrupted. It is very weak often. However, as we were saying, right up till the attainment of the 10th Bodhisattva Bhumis, enlightenment is something that is at the moment beyond our understanding. Enlightenment means when there is a total exhaustion of all deluded concepts. Whatever is not real, whatever is merely mind's supposition, whatever is a vivid creative imagination of the mind that has been let loose to appear, to manifest, to sort of create the levels of entertainment, when all of them are truly seen for what it is, then there is a complete dissolution, complete dissolving of all of these that are merely mind's projection. At such a point of realization that we call enlightenment, what we call mind and what we call mind's appearance both begin to simply rest in whatever the true nature is. And at such a point, the very easy way to approach this is to ask yourself the question, what is not created by your mind? And ultimately, what is the nature of the mind itself? When you rest with these two questions, you will find very few, if any at all, things left to be sort of playing around with. So at that point, then there is not so much of a need to have plans and strategies. For anything to be caught, there has to be something to catch. When that something to catch itself dissolves into its true nature of being merely mind's own appearance, then why would the mind madly run around after it? If you look at, for example, a blank wall, let's imagine this is a blank wall. And in this blank wall, we're all going to look at a fierce monster coming out, grabbing you by your neck, pulling you towards it, and forcing you to be angry, dominating your basic awareness. And I keep telling you, watch out. Now he is taking out his long teeth. It's coming towards you. Now, of course, some of you have so much blind faith these days that you may even begin to see a monster. That's not the point here. point is, there is still some people who keep talking about whatever is being talked about here. I don't see a monster here. I don't see what is the whole thing that is creating so much fear. Now, the same metaphor can be taken for levels of knowing what is true. Gampopa, one of the greatest masters of the Kagyu tradition, often refers in his text the example of the flower in the sky, the beautiful flower in the sky. And he says, how can the beautiful flower in the sky disturb a meditator's mind? Can it or can it not? It's up to the meditator. If those of us who have such an excellent habit of making such exaggerations of everything, such as one thought that can be prolonged for 20 years, and you eat medicine and you go to doctors like Dr. Joe Lux here, and have all the psychological treatments. So 20 years ago, my parents did this, and my father did that, and my mother did this. Yes, of course, there are tremendous abuses that people go through which impact psychologically. I know that. But on the other hand, it's up to you how long you're going to drag it to. You have to know that. So in the same way, this may be very strong and impactful thing in one's life. Let's take anger, for example, grudge, for example. 15 years ago, I was at a Dharma center. You didn't smile at me. Therefore, I'm not going to join your lineage at all. There are some people who make all these odd connections. I was going to be a Buddhist, but then there was this bad Buddhist at the gate, and I never became a Buddhist for the last 10 years or something like that. These are stories that I hear every day, isn't it? But this is how a thought can be so very powerful. It's the power of exaggeration that our mind can actually conjure. And therefore, where this kind of a tendency of bigness and exaggeration is dissolved, and one has the ability and the honestness of saying, what flower in the sky? And I have a choice of believing that or being more acutely sort of unified with the truth of the nature as it is. What monster? What thought? What appearance? Just as I open my eyes and I see room full of people, just as I close my eyes and every one of you come back into my mind. And then ultimately this mind, if I were to look for it, where could it be found? And one begins to really spend time in the expansiveness and yet in the very simplicity of mind and appearances, intertwined relationship, the union of mind and appearance, and ultimately the nature of the mind itself, then all 3,000, as the Tantra says, all 3,000 realms arises in my mind stream, the mind stream that is essentially empty in nature, and in that as one abides. Abiding is the state of bodhisattvahood. That abiding, becoming a fully ripened realization from where you don't return is called enlightenment. And therefore, enlightened state is said to be where there is no more continuity of the entertainment that we call you and I. This and that, big and small, good and bad. And so where there is a genuine sense of exhaustion, that state is called enlightenment. So these have to be also somewhat thought about as stages from the ground of meditation leading to the accomplishment of the bhumis to the ultimate realization, such as that which has been obtained by Buddha Shakyamuni himself. Now, in order to reach and traverse the paths and the bhumis, one must then practice the bodhisattva path. Bodhisattva path, very quickly, as it is said, bodhisattva path that can arise based upon 5 factors. The first is the presence and the inspiration of great spiritual masters. One way in which one is introduced to the bodhisattva path through which the enlightened mind can be arisen or can be generated and realized is by association, by being with the teachers, by receiving the teachings and the presence and the inspiration, such as then very commonly as we see in the presence of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, non-Buddhist absolute people who have no idea what Buddhism or the Dalai Lama is even, chances upon His Holiness, and we find them very very, very sort of extraordinarily relate to good-heartedness, to being kind, to being peaceful. And therefore, that is the kind of inspiration that can arise. Second is said to be bodhicitta, and the ability, the potential to walk on the bodhisattva path arises through the strength of one's own awakening. And so through, if a person's mind is clear, if a person is thoughtful, if a person is someone who is able to give birth to introspection in one's own life, then without reliance upon a teacher, by one's own personal awakening also, the bodhicitta can arise. Third is then said to be through the power of virtue, where virtue is something that one cultivates. If a person has a lot of virtuous attitude, where physically, verbally, mentally, one abstains from harming the others, such a person will not have to necessarily know anything about Buddhism and yet will be on the path of the bodhisattvahood. That is a very important thing to keep in mind. Knowing this leads us to then knowing that bodhisattvas are not limited to being Buddhists and Buddhist practitioners. Fourth is then bodhicitta and the bodhisattva path and the realization of the awakened heart may arise also through the fourth factor, and that is through hearing, contemplating, meditating on the Mahayana teachings. This is then what most of us relate to. Fifth is then said to be bodhisattva or bodhicitta that arises through the strength of one's own meditation. A person may not have heard many teachings, a person may not be a scholar or learned person, but through meditation, through shamatha, particularly shamatha and vipassana meditation, that samadhi has the power of generating clear recognition, understanding of the bodhicitta and the awakened heart within one's own self. Now, related to the vows of the bodhisattvahood, then according to both the traditions, tradition of Nagarjuna and the tradition of Asanga, there are varieties of ways of approaching. The common approaches, vows of bodhisattva involve things to abandon as well as things to cultivate. In accordance to Nagarjuna's tradition, there are 18 root vows to cultivate and 80 auxiliary or subsidiary vows to cultivate. So altogether, then there are the 98 vows that must be maintained by anyone who's taken the bodhisattva vow, which means most of you all who took yesterday, now you have to take, you have to know what are the 18 vows to keep, what are the 80 auxiliary vows to abandon. In accordance to the Nagarjuna's tradition, the first 18 root vows, 5 vows particular to leaders of the world, 5 vows particular to administrators and people of influence. In the olden traditional classical texts, it is said to be 5 vows for the kings, 5 vows for the ministers. But in today's changed world, most of the teachers have then sort of changed the terms to being, instead of kings, leaders, and instead of ministers, to people in administration and those who support the leaders or are in a position of influence, vows to be kept. And then the 10 vows are mainly for people, the 8 vows are mainly for what is called ordinary practitioners or ordinary human beings. Now, in general, if you sum them up all together, in general, these can be all found in the 8 vows of the ordinary person, because the leaders and the ministers or the administrators, the main vow to observe as a bodhisattva vow holder is not to be a cause of destruction and discouragement in the lives of the others. That's the main thing. But if you take the 8 that is common to everyone, then the first is, as a person who's taken the bodhisattva vow, to be free from fear of emptiness. Now, this is, I think, one of the very crucial things. Because if the mind doesn't explore the idea of emptiness of self and phenomena, the stinginess, the indifference, and the ignorance will always be there. The self-cherishing attitude will continuously be there. Therefore, as a vow holder of the Mahayana teachings, one must exert effort in understanding emptiness so that one is not falling prey to a Shravaka and a Pratyeka, solitary realizer's attitude, which is very important for all of us to keep in mind, because although most of us imagine that we would like to bring about the liberation and enlightenment of all sentient beings, but if the house catches fire, we often say, how many would stay back to help one another, and how many would rush out to save one's own self? Now here we are talking about emptying the cyclic existence. Do you have the patience and the endurance to wait until everybody gets going, isn't it? Everybody is free. Or at a certain crucial point, will your own self-cherishing attitude and the attachment to the self become more strong than the needs and the well-beings of the others? Therefore, in order to overcome a very easy sort of seduction that we may fall prey to, of the self-cherishing attitude that always will want your own individual liberation. Even in your practices, if you really examine, when you sit in meditation, are you meditating for yourself or are you meditating for the others? When you say something like, where do I find the inspiration to practice? Sometimes you do that. So if you find the inspiration to practice and to being a Buddhist or to doing your practices only in things that comfort you and your senses, then you're always going to be very dependent upon external conditions. Then how the teacher behaves and relates to you will become very important. Which place you are and where you are meditating will become very important. Whether the place you are meditating is conducive or not, whether you have a lot of Sangha members supporting you or not, or whether you are in an isolated place far away from everybody or not, all of these factors will become very, very important to you. But if at the heart there is simply the wish to bring about genuine goodness that can be of genuine help and liberation to all sentient beings, and if that is the only intent with which you are practicing, such a person will then no longer be dependent upon conducive external causes and conditions to encourage and inspire you to the path of practice. The motivation of bodhicitta alone is very sufficient. Therefore, to be free from such tendencies, the first vow is to be free from the fear of emptiness, to consistently explore the teachings on Prajnaparamita. Second is to abandon being overpowered by jealousy, and because of jealousy, disparaging others or promoting self and loved ones. And so, again, thinking very carefully, jealousy is the biggest defect or the impediment to our path of practice. We may not necessarily be sort of what we call cutthroat jealousy or a very abject jealous person, but subtle jealousy is one of the factors or the defects or the kleshas, discursivenesses that we all suffer from. For example, the whole language, I often say, of Buddhism or maybe even other religion, but particularly in Buddhism, where so much emphasis is given to you must find the cause of liberation and happiness for all sentient beings, I think psychologically sometimes makes you begin to think, well, then you're the it person. And that's a tremendous pressure you begin to take upon yourself. Now, ultimately, if I don't get it, everybody's happiness is at stake here. Everybody's liberation is at stake here. You begin to imagine yourself, and then suddenly sometimes you find, no, you have to be the recipient of somebody else's kindness. And that's very difficult to take. We are all in this mad rush to be the kind person. But when it comes to receiving somebody else's kindness, receiving somebody else's help, then there's nobody. You'd all like to be the speaker. There's nobody who listens. So that's why we say in Tibetan, all kings and no subject, isn't it? That's the kind of problem that often arises. And this then, sort of a thing will come if the mind has begun to make more of one's own self and one's own path of practice. And it is in that way that we may have subtle jealousy with one another. And so among Sangha members, among Buddhists, this is a common practice, common ailment, disease that is there. Where there are, you know, Buddhists are very kind to other non-Buddhists. Buddhist being kind to another Buddhist is a very rare thing to see. We are polite, but we are very passive-aggressive towards one another. And that is one of the biggest, I think, defects and probably cause for not having progress, genuine progress within our own self, because there's a certain tightness and a rigidity, and that tightness and rigidity comes because there's always a sense of upmanship, one-upmanship among one another. And that's really unnecessary, but that's how we do. Sometimes people say, that's not true, Rinpoche, we love each other, then, okay. I don't believe you, but because I live with you all my whole life. But if it encourages you to do better, then it's always very good. So there are lots of good people, very patient people, but there's a lot of room for improvement. And therefore, jealousy is something that I think is very, very important to work, especially when it comes to, because of your jealousy, you disparage others. Now, this is very common. If you are a new one to Buddhism, you are in that romantic phase, so you haven't found much things to complain about. So that's very good. Enjoy it as long as it lasts. Those of us who have been born into Buddhism and have been with Buddhists, then we know sectarianism is there, politics is there, territoriality is there. How many Dharma centers do you have in New York, and how much the Dharma centers interact with one another? It's an old story. Why does that happen? That happens because there's jealousy. This happens because there is one-upmanship. There is because there is territoriality, and this is contradictory to what we teach others. The poor new Buddhists who are here have absolutely no idea, and sometimes it's very embarrassing when they will find out. It's very, very embarrassing, but that's the way it is. And that's why, if you have taken the bodhisattva vow and you've gotten into this kind of a habit, then realize that you are actually breaking your bodhisattva vows. Now, where are we? Instigating confusion is the third sort of negative habit to abandon for a person who has taken the bodhisattva vows. And instigating confusion is where your behavior and the teachings you teach do not match one another and causes confusion in the minds of the others. This is particularly for the teachers who are teaching. If you are in the capacity of teaching somebody else, then it has to be absolutely clear that your conduct and attitude matches with what you are teaching. A lot of times people say things like, do what I say, not what I do. That kind of a thing for a teacher, for a Mahayana Buddhist practitioner, is not permitted. Fourth is, through your actions, direct and indirectly discouraging another person on the path of generating compassion. Through your own sympathy to another person, and this then happens in the West a lot, where people encourage others to wait before you take the bodhisattva vow, where your actions directly and sometimes indirectly with whatever you have expressed discourages another person from entering the Mahayana teachings, engaging in working with one's own self. Such is then said to be the fourth action to be abandoned. Fifth is then abandoning patimoksha, seeing the Mahayana teachings as superior, whether out of fondness, whether out of admiration, whether out of devotion, or whatever reasons it may be. But because of one's own practice of the Mahayana teachings, degrading or criticizing the Hinayana teachings, particularly the Pratimoksha vows. This also includes criticizing monks and nuns and seeing them as lesser in capacity to one's own Mahayana practices. Sixth is becoming a cause for another to abandon the Hinayana path. And so if you, with your fondness for Vajrayana teachings or Mahayana teachings, become a cause for someone to abandoning Hinayana teachings, that is also breaking the bodhisattva vow. Seventh is then said to be intentionally slandering someone. So slandering of someone, using your speech to criticize, especially for meditators, one thing that you have to keep in mind is as you grow more mature with the Dharma, with the philosophy, with the wisdom of the enlightened beings, mistaking knowledge to being realization. When you mistake information and knowledge with wisdom, wisdom that is nothing but your own experience, and knowledge is something that you have a theory of, an intellectual understanding of, when you mistake these two things, and the mind doesn't really become experienced in what it is, sort of whatever knowledge it is acquiring, cynicism and criticism or critical ideas of the other often grow. The more spiritual the person, the more cynical sometimes the person will become. The more learned the person, the more critical the person will become. So this is the then sort of disease where you confuse information with wisdom, with real, genuine realization. And at such a point where the criticism and the critical tendencies become more strong, then without even our realizing, sometimes one begins to slander others. One begins to then think critical of the others. Slandering others intentionally, particularly, is then breaking the Mahayana precepts. Likewise, also, with the motivation to profit or to gain, to claim oneself to be more accomplished in meditation, and that is again for all practitioners, to claim to be more accomplished, more realized in the learnings of the Dharma, simply to gain profit, praise, or respect of the others. These are the eight precepts or eight negative actions that must be abandoned by all meditators of the Bodhisattva path in accordance to the Nagarjuna's tradition. 80 auxiliary vows are given in short in this way. 24 vows that arises, 24 downfalls or the breaking of the vows that arises from the single tendency, and that tendency is called cultivating disinterest in the happiness of the others and being indifferent to the suffering of the others. When there is an indifference towards the sufferings of the others, when there is a disinterest in engaging or exerting effort in bringing happiness to the others, there are 24 different actions that lead to such an attitude and a conduct. These are called the 24 sort of actions to be avoided. Then there are 16 actions that come from one reason, and that is neglecting to accomplishing, bringing relief of pain in the lives of self and the others. Whatever is a cause of pain to yourself and to the others, if one neglects to make an exerted effort in bringing about the relief, then 16 different categories are given, which are then said to be brought together, the first 24 and the 16, 40 different actions that must be avoided. But if you condense them, they are all gathered into these three things: to have no interest in the well-being of the others, to be indifferent to the sufferings of the others, and then not to make an effort to bring the relief from pain of self and others from suffering. In these three actions are all the 40 actions that are gathered in the 80 auxiliary sort of vows or commitments of the Bodhisattva vow in accordance to Nagarjuna. Now, how does it become 80? Is 40 of these can be also brought into two situations. One is called incidental and the second is called continuous. 40 of these that I just spoke about, the indifference, the sort of disinterest in the well-being, as well as not making the effort to bring relief from pain. These three, if they are incidental. Incidental means suddenly you're struck in a situation where you encounter such situations and you do not respond to it despite the fact that you've taken the Bodhisattva vows. So 40 incidental breakages or downfalls. And if these 40 continue to also become your laid-back attitude and you sustain them for a longer period of time and it becomes continuous. So continuous means it becomes a sort of a instilled habit to have the disregard for the well-being of the others, to be indifferent about the sufferings and the pain, and primarily to be lazy. So lazy that you just can't bring about yourself the exertion to bring about the relief from pain of the others. If it becomes continued, then those are the 40 continued habits. So therefore, they are called 40 incidental failings and 40 continuous failings, which add up to then being the 80 auxiliary sort of faults that can arise. Now, in the case of the Asangas tradition, then there are again what are called the 18 root vows and the 40 auxiliary vows. And so in these ways, Asanga's tradition, it's much more sort of in-depth given as the 18 root falls, downfalls that must be carefully guarded. Again, if you condense them, all of the 18s are gathered into what are called cultivating the four white dharmas and abandoning the four black dharmas. So very quickly, the four black dharmas or the negative actions that must be abandoned according to Asanga's tradition, for those who have taken the bodhisattva vows, is to intentionally, the first to abandon is to intentionally lie to another person, particularly an object of veneration, such as one's teacher and preceptors, to intentionally lie when asked a question. That's one thing to be abandoned. Second is to develop strong negative attitude, and then to have sort of happiness in your negative attitude, to defend it, to be complacent, to actually have high regard towards it, and then find your mind inspired in continuing with that negative action. That's the second downfall. Third is to outright be disrespectful to others through verbal criticism, as well as by physical actions and thoughts. Fourth action that must be abandoned, negative action that must be abandoned, is to deceive another sentient being. And so according to Asanga, this is what we do every day. For example, I always say when we make sort of the aspirations and dedication, and we say, may I be able to liberate all sentient beings from the ocean of samsara. Dedication that you all know, isn't it? Sonamde Thamje Zegpani, from the ocean of samsara, may I free all beings. That's a very big commitment you're making every day. So when you are not living true to what you have been reciting each day, then that is also deceiving other sentient beings. And so one has to, as a bodhisattva vow holder, always be able to recollect that vow in one's own mind and exert effort in bringing transformation in one's attitude and conduct. The four cultivations, white dharmas as they are called, or the four virtuous actions that have to be cultivated. First one is to be honest in your speech, to speak the truth, and to speak with the intention to bringing freedom from suffering and the obtaining of happiness of the others. Second is to place the needs of the other as more important than your own. Third, to recognize everyone as a bodhisattva, to see everyone as a bodhisattva, to see everyone as an object of respect and veneration. Fourth is to have compassion beyond assumed limitations of one's ability. We always think, I can do only this much. To always exert effort to go a little bit beyond what you think are your limitations. These are the four things to cultivate. In general, Asangas, in Asanga's tradition, 40, or in, again, another way of counting, 46 auxiliary vows are there. Again, very quickly to give them. Seven vows are connected to the generation of generosity. Nine vows connected to ethics. Four vows connected to patience. Three vows connected to exertion. Three vows connected to samadhi. Eight vows connected to wisdom. Three vows with diligence. 3 vows again with samadhi, 8 with wisdom, 12 what are called vows of benefiting other sentient beings. But both of the traditions of Nagarjuna and Asanga, of course, gather in the same discipline of seeing the 6 paramitas as the main vows to cultivate. The paramita of generosity, being generous with dharma, inspiration to the others, with material wealth, with giving protection, and most importantly, being generous so that you can become a cause of liberation from samsara for all sentient beings, is the act of generosity, the first vow that must be maintained and kept by all Mahayanists. Second is ethics. One must, if one has committed oneself to developing compassion, be ethical. And ethics rests in the cultivation of clear awareness of what to abandon and what to cultivate, making sure that all negative actions of body, speech, and mind are abandoned, all pure actions of the body, speech, and mind are cultivated. The third vow in both the traditions is patience, and that is to be patient with oneself and one's shortcomings and faults, to be patient with the others, to be patient when one is the object of aggression, to be patient when one's loved ones are the object of aggression or pain. And then in the text it says, to be patient in enduring suffering, which is, I think, very important to keep in mind, because many of you tend to be good Buddhists or good compassionate practitioners until you fall sick or until you hit a difficult situation or circumstance in your life. And then the problem becomes so big that it seems to sort of engulf even the little bits of enthusiasm to practice. Whenever you encounter difficulty, it is then that moment where one must exert even greater effort in terms of practice. So if you're doing half an hour of meditation each day and then you fall sick, you should do 1 hour of practice each day. That's how it is. Now, of course, physically, if you're unable to get up or sit up or whatever it is, that's different. But it's the mind that must connect with the practices, that sees greater wisdom in the teachings in a much more experiential way. That's where you are able to actually encounter life in such a way that it is beyond just being a theory. So therefore, enduring circumstances that are difficult is then being able to practice the vow of patience. Likewise, then the fourth vow is effort, generating genuine effort where one enthusiastically and joyfully is able to practice in generating kindness, loving kindness and compassion towards all. Exertion comes where there is a little bit of sense of humor, and that sense of humor is extremely important. There's a chapter that Lochan Dharmashri actually devotes to only cultivating joy and humor related to the topic of generation of effort, which is very important because spirituality through times has been so much seen as a path of sacrifice and being good and you being the one that's giving up everything and the others not understanding you and so forth, that as soon as you say you're a meditator or a spiritual practice, the burden of being good sometimes is so strong that one loses the joyfulness of actually being someone who's doing something remarkably good. So therefore, it has to be able to recognize, and that joyfulness doesn't come if you yourself do not treasure and value what you are practicing. If you see what you are practicing as something that you're sacrificing for, something that you're giving up, if you're always looking at what you lost from the practice of generating compassion rather than what a wonderful, marvelous thing. And yesterday in the Bodhisattva prayer, there is just like a blind person finds a jewel in a heap of dust, and then how exciting can that be? So then it is in the same way that you have found the opportunity to do something good in your life, and that should be a cause of great enthusiasm and joyfulness, and not sadness, and not burdensome, and not so gloomy that the burden of being good makes you discouraged and disappointed and depressed and so sort of going around saying, why me? Why am I the one supposed to be liberating all sentient beings, and so on and so forth. So that's a mistaken way to look at it. Fifth vow that one takes is concentration, or the samadhi, and that arises with stability of mind, mindfulness, and a continuum of awareness, particularly in post-meditation. One must understand meditation as just the key that unlocks your mind with awareness. True meditation is in post-meditation. In the very traditional rituals that we use, a gong, for example, to begin a session of meditation, our teachers used to say, just as one clap or one gong that starts you on the meditation, likewise, formal meditation should be just the instigator. So you meditate for that moment, and then you enter into post-meditation that is permeated with awareness, with mindfulness. So that is the kind of awareness and mindfulness that needs to be cultivated. Wisdom then comes with, as we have been talking about, the deepened insight gained from realizing the true nature of self and phenomena. And so in these, and the generation of wisdom, therefore, becomes the sixth vow that needs to be maintained by a person who has received the bodhisattva vow. So it is in this way, and of course the chapter itself is very, very elaborate in explaining all the different facets of the bodhisattva vow. But again, one of the, I think, important things to keep in mind is what is a misconception that many, many people have, and that is, it is easy to break one's own vow. And therefore, bodhisattva vow, for example, here, it is said, isn't very easily broken. Yesterday, or day before yesterday, I mentioned, patimoksha vow is like a clay pot. Once broken, it is very difficult to repair. Bodhisattva vow is like a brass pot. It can get dented, but you can always make it sort of break. So it is said that the bodhisattva vow, many people say, I've broken my bodhisattva vow. So to break a bodhisattva vow is actually quite difficult, because to break a bodhisattva vow, first of all, you must have created a downfall, or what is called a defeat. Downfall is when you make a mistake. A downfall doesn't constitute breaking the vow. A vow is only broken when it enters into a state called defeat. Defeat is where you have no sense of shame or remorse for a negative action that you have done for a very prolonged period of time. If you've done something really bad or unkind, and you have no sense of regret or remorse for it for a prolonged period of time, then the downfall could transform into a defeat. Likewise, after having created a negative attitude, if you have tremendous rejoicement in having inflicted pain and harm, or being unkind to the others, and you prolong it over for a period of time, such is then said to again be a downfall that becomes a defeat. In the same way, encouraging yourself to repeatedly do the action again and again, such as if you've been very unkind to a person and you repeatedly encourage yourself to repeat that action again and again over a period of time, only at such a point a downfall could change into a defeat. If it changes into a defeat, and for a period of time you have no regret, you encourage yourself, you take great pride, you have no shame, you have a sense of repetition of that behavior again and again, then such a person needs to renew the vow all over again. But only simply having made errors, a mere confession is said to be sufficient. And that confession in the bodhisattva vow does not even have to be to a preceptor. If your mind generates regret, if your mind generates a sense of stronger determination not to repeat the action, and in visualization and in your recalling the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, if you generate a strong determination not to do it again, but to do better the next time, that is itself called confession. I don't think the term is appropriate, but nevertheless, this is the common term that is used these days, so it doesn't really go well when you think of, you know, the Catholic confession or the kind of confession things that you do. There is no punishment sort of or anything to do, but it is a sense of the power of determination that brings the purification. So a downfall can be like a brass pot. It can be dented, but it cannot be broken. A defeat, of course, requires one to go to a preceptor and take the vow all over again.